Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. Henry was the absolute image of a king. He was thick-set, red-haired, strong, broad and powerful. As a contemporary claimed, he had a face upon which a man might gaze 1,000 times and still feel drawn to gaze again. His accomplishments during his 34-year reign were unmatched in English history. He was Europe's trailblazer. Yet his astute leadership would be blighted as he yearned to control everything in his midst. First the church, and then his own family, would dampen the rampant flames of perhaps England's greatest reign thus far. This is Henry II. Henry was born in Le Mans on the 5th of March 1133. During his childhood, his fiercely ambitious parents fought for his future. His mother was Empress Matilda, daughter of King Henry I. She was occupied during Henry's early years fighting her cousin Stephen for the crown of England. His father, Geoffrey Plantagenet, Count of Anjou, was busy conquering Normandy. Apart from the odd failed conquest in England, the teenager stayed in Angers and was well educated in the cradle of the Plantagenet dynasty. When his father died in 1151, Henry ruled the domains of Anjou, Maine, Normandy and Touraine. His astonishing inheritance, however, was incomplete. The Angevins were known for their hot tempers, voracious energy, military genius, political acumen, engaging charm, and robust constitution. Henry was no exception. By 1152, Henry had won the heart of the Queen Consort of France, Eleanor of Aquitaine, a powerful leader in her own right, a veteran of the Crusades, and 10 years his senior. She was in an unhappy marriage. She was a vibrant, fiery, determined woman who did not fit the mould in the conservative French court. The pious Louis was described by Eleanor as a monk, not a king. She also bore him just 2 daughters. With time running out to produce a male heir, Louis grew impatient. The strong, dynamic Duke Henry was a perfect match. Louis annulled the marriage. Within weeks she had married Henry, much to Louis's dismay. 7 children produced by Henry and Eleanor would make it to adulthood, including 4 sons, Henry, Richard, Geoffrey, and John. Another bitter pill for Louis to swallow. Compounded by this for Louis was her choice of suitor, an Angevin. Angevins, people of Anjou, were described as savages who desecrated churches, murdered priests, and had disgusting table manners. But there was a more serious concern for Louis to worry about. With the marriage, Henry acquired the Duchy of Aquitaine, doubling his land overnight, and forming an increasingly foreboding shadow upon France. Henry would remain a deep thorn in Louis's side for the rest of his life. Henry's appetite was still not satisfied. After several disastrous attempts to take England by force, he embarked upon a shrewd, peaceful propaganda tour of England. It was the perfect medicine for the English, after 20 years of bitter, miserable civil war, and it won him the crown upon the death of his mother's biggest adversary, King Stephen. His domain was now astounding. His land stretched from Scotland to the Pyrenees, more land than his predecessors could have dreamed of, and still it would grow. Henry II was crowned at Westminster Abbey on the 8th of December 1154. He inherited a shambles. Royal revenue had fallen by 2/3. Despotic barons were ungovernable, operating from illegal castles, armed with iniquitous foreign mercenaries, with the common people at their mercy. This had to change, and fast. Henry, a student of Emperor Augustus, realized he needed to control those who had the power to remove him. First, Henry set about destroying the illegal castles. He did this by hiring his own mercenaries, trained in castle sieges, who would be permanent warriors loyal to the king. The difficulty in besieging castles was the reason the anarchy was so long and bitter. Now Henry was able to take them with speed. Foreign mercenaries who were not loyal to the king were sent away, and a scutage, a tax, was levied upon the earls who could now be tethered. Henry's remarkably swift consolidation was done with a tone of reconciliation, not revenge. This meant it was clean, with relatively little resistance or bloodshed. It made a mockery of his predecessor. He also went about building his own castles, including his most prized possession, still intact today, Dover. While these tones of peace would echo around England, Henry's days of conquest were far from over. In his first 20 years, Henry was belligerent, chiefly interested in territorial gains. His primary objective was to conquer his immediate neighbours. First, he took back the land lost to Scotland, Northumbria, from Malcolm IV. Southern Scotland also came under English control when Malcolm paid homage. In 1165, Henry had gained the fealty of the majority of the Welsh princes. Then in 1171, he did what no English monarch had done previously. He successfully invaded Ireland. He gained the fealty of nearly all the Irish kings, as well as papal approval. Henry still wasn't finished. He set his sights on the remaining vassals in modern-day France. Due to his acquiring of Aquitaine, the county of Toulouse was now an exclave of the domain of France and surrounded by Angevin dominions to the north and to the west, which meant an invasion was very much plausible, using a weak claim to the county through Eleanor's grandmother. Using the scutage to raise the huge amount of money required, Henry besieged Toulouse. His force inflicted misery upon the countryside, and the county seemed likely to become the latest victim of the Angevins. However, Louis was still the overlord of Toulouse, a testament to how quickly fortunes changed in medieval politics and warfare. Louis's mere appearance led to Henry thinking twice. He did not want open war with a king whose land bordered nearly all of his continental territory. Henry simply left. The other region in his sight was Brittany. He would gain control in a different way. Duke Conan IV was forced out and replaced with his 5-year-old daughter, who was then handed over and eventually betrothed to Henry's third son, Geoffrey, who would become the Duke of Brittany. Henry was at the height of his power. The British Isles were largely under his control, and his continental land secured for now. Henry now had the tremendous task of maintaining authority over his domain. He was a man of boundless energy, who was constantly moving. To the very end, he could cover the distance of 4 or 5 days' ride in just one. This gave him a crucial advantage. He could arrive to quell revolts and catch armies by surprise by arriving a few days earlier than expected. He was known to pop up in any of his dominions without prior warning, which meant it was very difficult to even spread whispers of a rebellion, with the king at any time seemingly able to appear upon the horizon. Spending around 40% of his time in England and 60% on the continent, he split his time between his dominions with far more expedience than many of his predecessors or successors. It wasn't just in territorial gains where Henry would focus, but also in domestic policy. Back in England, he was keen to revive his grandfather Henry I's vision of a fair criminal justice system. While Henry had subdued the barons and returned the country to relative peace, he was to go further and transform law and order. The size of his territory meant stimulated growth in localized administrations, dealing with financial and judicial matters. He created the common law, by which every citizen would be subjected, regardless of stature, wealth, or locality. A strong, centralized judicial system was required. The Assize of Clarendon in 1166 replaced trial by combat with a grand jury of 12, who would circuit the country, deciding on cases through evidence, inspection, and inquiry, while adhering to the national standard of practice. This transformed English law. It would spread globally, and sow the seeds for the justice system in place today. To prevent corruption, Henry's men would monitor the courts themselves as they travelled around the country. Such was the king's energy and drive, he often performed the task personally. Trial by combat slowly but surely disappeared from English law, and the common law and grand jury would organically become part of the justice system. Not all establishments would fall so willingly under Henry's umbrella of commonality. His attempt to subvert the church would become Henry's greatest legacy. When Henry saw his greatest adversary, the French King Louis VII at Toulouse in 1159, he sought counsel. The majority advised to turn away and concede. One man who wanted to attack was Thomas Becket, Henry's best friend. Becket was not a baron. He'd had an irresistible rise in Canterbury to become the Chancellor. A key aide and friend of Henry, he would dominate his court, and it was often Becket acting in Henry's stead, not the Queen. As described by William Fitzstephen, friend of Becket's, never in Christian times were two men more of a mind. The inseparable pair were known to giggle like two schoolboys at a play. However, the two were not a match in personality. Henry was modest and virile, whereas Becket was ostentatious and celibate. While Henry disliked the pomp and ceremony of kingship, Becket more than made up for it. Once, when Becket travelled to Paris as a royal diplomat, he did so with an entourage of 200 strong, with hawks, hounds, monkeys, horses, and copious amounts of luxurious gifts. Henry was known to keep him in check and prick his pride. To undermine him, he often rode straight into Becket's dinner hall on horseback and sit down to eat, while Becket was adulating with guests. In 1162, all would change with the death of the Archbishop of Canterbury. The church was still outside the jurisdiction of common law. The church was supremely powerful. During the anarchy, it had kept the people together as an inimitable place of solace. New abbeys and cathedrals sprang up everywhere. The church in England was more powerful than anywhere else in Northern Europe. The main grievance of Henry was simple. 1/6 of the population of England was employed by the church, and not subject to common law. They could commit heinous crimes and be protected by church courts. Punishments were spiritual and far more lenient, such as suspensions or simply paying penance. Henry decided he needed a trusted figurehead to do his bidding, to subjugate the church, and who better than Thomas Becket? The appointment was seen as an outrage. Becket had been a deacon, but he was no monk, and did not have the experience to command such a role. The relationship between Henry and Becket illuminated the king's intentions. Becket was very resistant. However, you don't refuse a king. He was quickly ordained and appointed. The concession of Becket was given with a sharp utterance to the king. An omen. It will be God I serve before you. He was appointed in May 1162. His first action was to resign as Chancellor. He defied the king in almost every fashion, becoming the church's most staunch defender. He was an ascetic. He wore a hair shirt, slept on a cold stone floor, ate the sparest of diets, and daily exposed his back to the lash of the monks of Canterbury. The first wave of antagonism came when Becket refused to allow the king's brother William to marry. William died a short time later of a broken heart. This was the beginning of perhaps the greatest feud in medieval history. Henry was told that in the 9 years of his reign thus far, over 100 murderers had escaped true punishment due to the protection of the church court. Enough was enough. He put forward the Constitutions of Clarendon in 1164. Among the 16 articles, the most salient was the one that proclaimed that those clergymen that the ecclesiastical courts had tried and defrocked could no longer be protected and could be further punished under the jurisdiction of secular courts. Becket, predictably, refused it. Henry finally sought to remove Becket. At a council in Northampton, charges were made against the Archbishop, including embezzlement and ignoring a summons. He was required to befall all property and goods at the king's mercy. While Becket was now openly a devout servant of God, he was still known for brazen showmanship. At Northampton, Becket approached the king, brandishing his cross like a sword, proclaiming, "This gave him the protection of God." Henry sneered. "Were you not the son of one of my villeins?" To which Becket responded, "You adhere and rely too much on the manner of your ascent." Becket was able to flee. He went into exile under the protection of Henry's old foe, Louis VII. There he remained for 6 years. Several attempts were made to reconcile the pair. The Pope was especially keen to reunite the old friends for the sake of the church. Henry, however, grew more bitter and Becket more devout. To kill all carnal desires, Becket regularly ordered his own scourging until the blood flowed. Henry decided to act against the church by having his first son, also named Henry, crowned the young king, effectively crowning the heir. It was something refused to Stephen when he tried to do the same for his son Eustace. This was against the wishes of the Pope and Becket. An apparent truce was made to pave the way for Becket's return. He would crown Henry again and have his land returned to him. However, the damage was done. Becket returned with no less vigour. The more potent and fierce he is, the harder the chain is needed to bind him. He immediately excommunicated every single bishop and priest who presided over the young king's coronation, and even predicted a flurry of martyrs. Henry was known for his temper. As Gerald of Wales said, his grey eyes glowed fiercely and grew bloodshot with anger. Upon hearing the news of Becket's defiance, uttered some very famous and consequential words. "What miserable drones and traitors have I nurtured and promoted in my own household, who let their lord be treated with such shameful contempt by a low-born cleric? Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest?" 4 knights slipped away and headed to Canterbury. They confronted Becket and tried to arrest him. Becket would not go quietly. Edward Grimm described what happened next. The wicked knight, fearing that the Archbishop would be rescued, wounded this lamb. He was sacrificed to God, cutting off the top of his head. Then he received a second blow. he fell on his knees and elbows. Then the third knight inflicted a terrible wound as he lay, by which his sword was broken. The blood turned white from his brain, yet no less did the brain turn red from the blood, and it dyed the surface of the church. One of those knights was a former friend of the king's brother William, who screamed with vengeful glee for his refusal to grant the marriage. As news spread of the murder, Europe trembled. Trembled with the news that an archbishop had been slain in the house of God. Perhaps the most infamous event in the history of medieval Europe and in Christendom, it was said to even exceed the wicked crimes of Nero. The knights vanished. The Pope refused to speak to anyone English for a week. Henry claimed Becket's death was not his intention and was deeply and openly contrite, but the world, it seemed, wanted his head. Henry left England for 6 months, perhaps to the one place no one would follow, a place described by contemporaries as barbarous and uncouth, with bestial sexual practices, and even ate meat during Lent, Ireland. He waited there for the dust to settle. Henry scrapped the constitutions of Clarendon, funded new churches and abbeys, but it would take more than that to calm the simmering mood at home and abroad. But Henry had new challenges to contend with. Having four sons, he would have been the envy of his grandfather, Henry I. However, the price of royal virility is the arduous task of distributing power while curtailing ambition. His second and third sons, Richard and Geoffrey, were given Aquitaine and Brittany, respectively. Young Henry, as heir, would be given everything, but not while Henry was alive, which meant he was given no real power, no duchy. He was even in debt, having no means to pay for his lavish lifestyle. His pride was shot, and he was deeply embittered. Queen Eleanor, long neglected by her husband for younger mistresses, still harboured personal ambition. She began stirring the pot. Louis, too, enthusiastically joined, whispering in the ears of Henry's sons. It meant by 1173, Eleanor, young Henry, Richard, and Geoffrey had joined Louis to perhaps rid Europe of its most notorious king. While Louis and young Henry received a message signed from the King of England asking for his son's return, Louis replied, "Nonsense. The King of England is right here." Such was the naivety and inexperience of a young king, he garnered support by promising the annexation of his own land, including Northumbria, for the support of Malcolm IV. The scene was set. King Henry, who had committed the most egregious of sins against the church, now faced rebellion from the majority of his own family. He was in a most precarious and desperate situation. What he did next was a masterstroke. In 1174, dressed in beggar's clothing, he took a new sacred pilgrimage. He walked barefoot in the streets, right to the altar of Canterbury, to the shrine of the now canonized Saint Thomas Becket. There he would pay penance. Every monk and abbot of Canterbury took turns to whip the king without restraint. He spent all day and all night praying for forgiveness at the tomb of his friend and foe. Henry had proven quite the master of propaganda in his life, and this was no exception. The news of his penance spread as the country seemed to finally forgive the king. The tide was turning. As the 50-year-old Eleanor, disguised as a man, took the dangerous road to meet the rebels, she was captured by the king's men and was arrested. Henry would be attacked on multiple fronts, but if ever there was a monarch suited for the challenge, it was him. The man who would ride relentlessly and pop up without warning was in his element. In less than a year, alone against 3 sons, a wife, and 2 kings, he defeated the rebellion with ease. Now would be the reckoning. But Henry didn't like war. He was more aggrieved with the loss of life than the love he gave to the living. His sons actually gained money and land from peace conference, but promised not to demand anything further from their father. The queen, however, was to suffer. With calculated malice, she was imprisoned away from her beloved home of Aquitaine. Malcolm and Scotland paid the biggest price. They became formal subordinates to Henry and all future kings of England. If Henry hoped that would resolve the family squabbles, he would be mistaken. In 1180, Louis VII, King of France, died and was replaced by his 15-year-old son, Philip. The bequeathing of immense power to someone half his age unleashed fury in young Henry, who still had nothing. Philip, who in the same manner as his father welcomed rebel sons of King Henry with open arms, fanned the flames of rebellion once more. The young Henry even attacked the lands of his own brother, Richard, who at this point was far more experienced as a significant ruler in Aquitaine. But in 1182, during a dastardly, depraved rampage of pillaging, young Henry died of dysentery. Fearing a trap, King Henry refused to visit his deeply remorseful, dying son. When confirmation reached the king, he proclaimed, "He cost me much, but I wish he'd lived to cost me more." In 1186, Geoffrey died after being wounded in a tournament. So bereaved was Philip, he tried to jump into his open casket. This left 2 sons, Richard and John. John, around 10 years younger than his elder brothers, was now becoming a player. Richard, always a favourite of Eleanor, had a deeply untrustworthy relationship with his father. First of all, Henry's favourite son was John. Henry also refused to allow Richard to marry his lover, Alice. Rumours were rampant that Henry's array of mistresses even included his son's prospective wife. Henry wanted Richard to give John his Duchy of Aquitaine so Richard could take the position that young Henry had as a king in waiting with no real power. Richard refused. He now grew paranoid that upon his departure for the Crusades, he would be betrayed and lose the crown to John. Henry now refused to confirm Richard as his successor. All the tensions, as well as Philip's whispers of deceit, led to the last rebellion of Henry's life in 1189. At Le Mans, the coalition of Richard and Philip attacked Henry's forces. Something happened, almost unprecedented. Henry conceded. At the concession, Henry promised land to Richard, but most importantly, he promised the crown upon his death. When Henry and Richard embraced, the king uttered his damnation. "God grant that I may not die until I have my revenge on you." The ailing Henry departed from his son for the last time. Once a boundless rider of unrelenting endurance, he had to travel in a litter, too weak to ride his own horse. On his deathbed, Henry ordered a list of all the men who had betrayed him. First on the list broke his heart. It was John. Just a few days later, on the 6th of July 1189, Henry died at the age of 56 and was buried at Fontevraud Abbey. Though he was unpopular upon his death, what would come after Henry's reign would remind the people what they had had. For 34 years, England was safe. She was at peace. Henry was bold and humble, with a countenance of fire. His shrewd diplomacy, law and order, and the boundless energy with which he traversed his vast domain were the keys to his success. But his thirst for absolute power not only destroyed his relationship with the formidable English church, but with what he valued above all, his own family. When he died, he felt defeated. He was defeated. As a chronicler described, he was a man savaged by jackals. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to send a question in, you can do by emailing in thekingsandqueenspodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet at kingsqueenspod, send a message on Instagram, kingsqueenspodcast. Next on my list is Richard I. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.